We'll open up the House Energy and Environment Committee, and this is an informational meeting only today, and I really appreciate the folks who came here in short notice, including, or we're actually going to flip the agenda and start with the Community Water Systems Update with Gail Shibley of the Department of Human Services. This, all the information we're hearing today, colleagues, are based on issues we've worked on in the past. I've asked agencies and different parties to come and provide updates. So we're going to hear today, this is our water day here in Community Water Systems, the wastewater permitting program updates from DEQ, and also we have a number of different folks who are going to talk about the situation in Klamath and a recent settlement that's occurred there. So it should be an interesting informational session. And thank you, Gail, for coming back after the presentation's last session. And good off to you.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health in the Department of Human Services Public Health Division. I really appreciate the opportunity to give you a brief update. I could, you know, talk about drinking water for days, as I know the good chair shares a passion for good, clean drinking water. You may recall that last legislative session, we discussed, you listened, and you provided us an opportunity to deal with some of the challenges and the concerns that we had about assuring safe drinking water in the state of Oregon. Just as a bit of a refresher, I brought a few slides, and I think you've got copies there as well. There are more than 3,600 public water systems in the state of Oregon. You see that most of them are very small. They make up, of course, community water systems, cities, mobile home parks, other municipalities, other kinds of residential, if you will, systems. Others are semi-residential, which is that people don't live there, but they come and visit and work and learn and drink the water, same population over and over and over again. Another group that shows red here, I apologize for not having color there on for your handouts, but the transient systems, so-called, are those that we have different populations of people coming, and those are campgrounds, parks, restaurants, motels. They're open 24/7, so to speak, or at least 365 days a year, but it's not the same population drinking them. So from a public health standpoint, it's not the same level of public health risk as it might be if it were the same people all the time. And then the very small systems, which are also called, we also call the state systems. Those are systems that serve 10 to 24 people 6 months, at least 6 months or more out of the year. 4 to 14 connections, those are smaller than the size of systems that are regulated under the US EPA Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, which is 15 connections and above, but nonetheless, they are stated in ORS 448. The legislature has told us that we need to assure safe drinking water in those systems or through those systems as well as the EPA-regulated systems. And you see that, that's who those systems are by type, by size. 91% of the water systems serve fewer than 500 people. So you can imagine that these are thousands of small systems all over the state who, frankly, work very, very hard every single day to try to deal with all of the rules and regulations and requirements that the federal government has laid out to make sure that every time you turn on the tap or open up a spigot, that water is safe. And meets all federal health standards. In terms of the population, though, most of the population of Oregon is served by about 54 water systems. You can just kind of track the population of the state of Oregon to identify where those systems are. So what we were really looking at last session in particular, or wanted to raise with you, was how to create and implement a fully capable drinking water system that would deal with what we identified as a real disparity. Oftentimes when people talk about health classifications of populations based on gender, age, ethnicity, race, disability, and so forth. For us in drinking water, it's the size and the capability of the drinking water system itself. Really, frankly, came down to a big versus little, urban versus rural kind of split that we were concerned about. So just a few short months ago, the legislature approved raising the current fees that we have, so that we stop subsidizing them with federal dollars and state general fund dollars, so that if they were a fee for service, that they were the fee for the total cost of that service. We also received an increase in general funding. Also received authorization to charge a sanitary survey inspection fee, and then we also put into statute the Drinking Water Advisory Committee. Happy to talk about any or all of those things, but I just want to touch on a few things here in terms of, as we are continuing to, we are up to our eyeballs right now in implementation of this of these kind of panoply of resources that you have provided to us. Here you see that when we talk about what's a fully capable system, well, that makes sure that means that we make sure as a public health system, a county and state system, that we adopt and implement all of the federal rules, that we provide good, in-depth, quality, timely, effective oversight, large and small, EPA and non-EPA. We deal with the significant non-compliance issues, which frankly Oregon has had to deal with. We have had a rather dubious distinction of being among one of the top states in the country in prior years of having, in terms of kind of chronic non-compliers. And I would only reference you back a couple slides to the size of the water systems as they struggle, given their small size and the lack of resources, perhaps some sophistication, training, equipment, and so on. But what that means is that we as a public health entity get to really focus in on and deal with these significant non-compliers, and we're seeing those numbers go down now, which is really absolutely terrific from a public health standpoint. We know we're on track and doing the right thing. And a big piece of that, of course, is related to the data. Are we getting the data we need? Do we know what it means? What are we doing with it? And how do we cycle that back around so that it informs, from a management standpoint, what we do and how we do it? So we've done a lot already in the past several months. We have worked with our Department of Agriculture and colleagues and all of the county health departments, and have dealt with intergovernmental agreements and contracts. We've adopted the sanitary survey inspection fee. We had hearings, rules hearings throughout the state, and some really great comments, and we're just filing those with the Secretary of State probably as I speak or very shortly thereafter. So we are on track there. We have revised and refined the Oregon Drinking Water Benchmark, which is Oregon Benchmark number 69, so that it, in addition to identifying the percentage of the population that receives water that meets all health-based standards, which is what it has always been, we also want to deal with the percentage of water systems providing safe water, again, to get at that disparity issue, so that whatever size system you get your water from, wherever you live in the state of Oregon, that we are focused on and helping assure safe water in those systems as well. We are also in the midst of trying to frankly, staff up and recruit and train and orient and bring up to speed just about a dozen staff people who can really who are really going to be the implementers on the ground with all of these literally thousands of systems. At the same time, we are also expanding participation in the Drinking Water Advisory Committee, and per the statute that was or the bill that was adopted in statute last session as well. We still have a lot more to do. In addition to all the things that are currently in process, there are some other things that that frankly are not even begun. And I would draw your attention to what I what Mr. Leland, my drinking water manager, calls the phone book rules. Each one of these is just one rule that each is thick enough to write on the spine of, and those are just three of the new rules that are coming our way from the federal government. Very important issues, don't get me wrong, but when I talk about, refer you back again a few slides back to the 91% of the systems that serve fewer than 500 population, trying to deal with things like this is a pretty daunting task. And so we will be very, very busy in helping make sure that folks know, A, what's in there, what does it mean, and, oh, by the way, how do I do it? And how do I do it every single day, every single hour throughout the year? That is going to be a very enormous job. The opposite of least, want to draw your attention to, while we're doing all of this good work, we're also hearing some waterfalls around the next curve, so to speak. And that is, there are some issues that we haven't even really raised to in-depth legislative discourse at this point, but we would be remiss if we didn't take advantage of this opportunity today to particularly identify some issues that we think are particularly important for the state of Oregon in the years and the decades ahead. And none of these are new issues. I would label these as issues of chronic and increasing concern, not new issues of concern in any way. One, of course, is around private wells. Our regulations go down, of course, to four connections. We are guesstimating and estimating with our colleagues at the Department of Water Resources that about 600,000 Oregonians get their water from private wells. Other than real estate transfer information, those are not monitored or tested or sampled or required to be. What's in those wells? Well, we know, among other things, that we have a problem with arsenic in the state. We know we have a problem with nitrates in some systems. And so what does that mean? What is the issue? And, oh, by the way, what should we as a state be doing about that? So I wanted to identify and flag that as an issue. Certainly for we need to continue moving forward on drinking water source assessments. Our partners at Department of Environmental Quality, absolutely integral collaborators with us in working on a pilot project monitoring both the surface and groundwaters for potential contaminants that have been identified through these source water assessments. You have to be careful what you ask for, because you might get it. Well, we are asking for what's going on out there and what are some of the contaminants that we need to be paying attention to. I want to flag this for you that we will be finding that out, and then we will be needing to discuss exactly what ought to be done as a result. Flooding and landslides, I was here just a few days ago talking about some of the human health impacts associated with our changing climate, whether it's from land use patterns or from global climate changes or in some other category, flooding and landslides, steep slope, other kinds of unforeseen changes to the landscape really has a significant impact on drinking water. Most of the population of the state is served by surface water. So while at the same time most of the systems rely mostly on groundwater, We have to be very sensitive to, cognizant of what impact does the kind of landslides, whether it's from winter storms or other kinds of land uses. What impact does that have on water intakes? We have a couple systems now. Arch Cape on the coast, for example, I would flag to you, is one that has particularly raised some significant concerns. They're afraid they're about to lose their water source. What do you do about that? How do you grapple with that? And what does that, what might that mean in a state like Oregon, where we've got expected about 1 million more Oregonians coming our way? We've also got more development in more parts of the state that may or may not be receiving municipal either drinking water or even wastewater. I would also mention along those veins, without making any sort of judgment in any way, capture a characterization of, imagine a bunch of 1 acre plots, septic drinking water well, septic drinking water well, septic drinking water well. Then you've also got changing precipitation amounts, perhaps some landslides, some other kinds of issues, and you can imagine that we recognize the health risks associated with that. So I appreciate the opportunity to come and share kind of what we're doing, what we've accomplished already, what we're in the midst of, what we have facing us right now in the face, and then some other things that we know are very much next on our plate. So with that, I'm happy to provide any other information or answer any questions.
Okay, great. Thank you. Gail, are there any questions for Gail?
Quickly.
Yes.
Continue, Gail.
Nice to see you.
You always do a great job for the state of Oregon.
Thank you.
Talk with us about the partnership you have with the Oregon Economic and Community Development Department and the fact that they manage our water and wastewater program dollars.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, what a wonderful question. Extremely important issue, and we work very closely with them. I won't pretend to do justice to the breadth or the depth of that partnership. Suffice it to say that we work hand in glove with them with a Safe Drinking Water Revolving Fund. In addition, Ann Hannes and Bob Repine and others at the department have been in some good discussions with me and the management within public health about how we can more, in a more integrated way, really identify what some of the aging infrastructure needs are and make sure that we are working in a way that kind of, in a synergistic way. As you may know, the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund, I have all these acronyms in my head, so I have to unpack them, I apologize, is in a separate category from the Clean Water Revolving Fund, which is, I believe, administratively managed by DEQ, but again, in partnership with OECDD. And while the two are separate, they're definitely linked and there is some connection. One in particular that I can't help but just kind of flag for you is that because the Drinking Water State Revolving Fund is as flush as it's been, kind of, because it's only received slightly lower federal funding over the years, and it's been capitalizing quite well on its own. We're not in a position to have to come to ask for any sort of recapitalization. My understanding is that the recapitalization request on the Clean Water Revolving Fund was not funded at 100%, and consequently, you have, all systems are connected. You have some projects out there around the state that we, meaning Drinking Water, we want to make sure that that our partners in the Clean Water Revolving Fund are getting the resources they need. The small communities are getting the resources they need, because otherwise they might be kind of tempted to reframe what it is they're trying to do and kind of stick a straw into our glass, so to speak. And while that's great, we're all Oregonians and everything has to work together, there's also a long list of projects and a long list of communities communities who need some very specific drinking water help too. So it's a terrific partnership. We realize we're all in this together. There's no such thing as your end of the boat is sinking, but we need to continue to work together and figure out if there's a way to solve the problems in a more holistic way.
Madam Chair, I'm glad you shared that last sentiment. I agree. It's very important that the Economic and Community Development Department is working arm in arm with you. There's a lot of pressure on that department to be funding projects that perhaps don't line up with the priorities that you have. And I think it's very important that that Mr. Wiepein works closely with you so that way those priorities and the funding streams do match up.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I can't help but mention that since he used to be my housing committee chair, you tell him to play nice with me. No, we certainly do. We certainly want to, and we certainly recognize how important it is.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Your panel. I just have a quick follow-up to that. For folks who aren't familiar with the Safe Drinking Water Revolving Fund, is it a loan? Is it a low-interest loan, or is it...
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's a loan.
Okay.
Submarket.
Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe the answer is maybe no relationship on my question here. What relationship, working relationship, do you have with USDA and their water and wastewater programs that they maintain? Because those are a huge funding source for rural Oregon as well.
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, I wish I could say something other than what I'm going to say, which is nothing. It's an issue, and it's frankly one that I've not pursued as vigorously as I think we need to. And I don't mean to speak beyond your question, except that we also recognize that regulation of water resources, for whatever reason, whether it's agriculture or any other, but certainly agriculture, also has an impact, at least a potential impact, on drinking water source quality, and we think that this is an opportunity site for some additional partnership that really Oregon has not been a party to.
Well, there ought to be a kick in the pants for USDA, because they have a tremendous amount of financial resources that they bring into these rural communities, and in my view, there ought to be a coordination between what they're funding sources have available and what you're trying to accomplish. So, just a thought. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for those comments. Appreciate it and share that sentiment. We'd certainly would like to encourage the federal government to provide more assistance wherever possible, and certainly with help with funding for water systems. Gail, I want to thank you for your hard work over the years in trying to reinvigorate this program. Colleagues, one of the, I think, most important roles that state government plays is in protecting drinking water for the citizens of Oregon. And I think people expect when they turn on their tap, whether it's coming from a municipal program or a community program, that their drinking water is going to be safe, or at a campground, or you know, somewhere else that you're visiting. So I think this is really an essential program. Glad to see you're finally getting the resources that you need in order to implement and enforce the program and provide technical assistance, because we know that people are out there. They want to do the right thing. They don't always have the tools to do that. So I appreciate you updating the committee. We'll certainly have you come back and provide future updates.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thanks again.
Appreciate it.
And now we're moving on to dirty water, the other end of the pipe. Sorry, Neil, I had to just say that. Because, you know, it's all connected anyway. And
I'm going to try to be at this end.
Well, if you're at the state of California, if you're with the state of California now, it's all one closed loop. So with that, we're going to bring up the Department of Environmental Quality to talk about give us an update on the wastewater permitting program that colleagues are, three of us who sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee, Natural Resources, we know that, again, there was an infusion of funding into your program in the past couple of sessions. So appreciate you being here and providing us an update on what you've been doing and how you've been making sure that you're meeting the Clean Water Act requirements.
Thank you, Chair. Well, good afternoon, Chair Dienfelder, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Neil Mullane. I'm the Interim Water Quality Administrator for DEQ. And today, I'd like to provide you an update on the work that we've been doing in our permit program. And we've provided to the legislature the report on the wastewater permitting program and the improvements and measures that we are implementing at the department. And the report is required under Senate Bill 45 that was passed in the 2005 legislature. And the department has responsibility for restoring and maintaining and enhancing Oregon's water. And we have experienced both successes and challenges in our effort to protect the water quality of the state. The water quality program has success stories, but we have also recognized that the department has room for improvement. For example, in 2001, the department's backlog for expired water quality permits was the highest in the nation. With about 60% of our national pollutant discharge elimination system permits for our individual permits awaiting renewal. The department was also not timely or consistent in reviewing the compliance reports for permitted facilities and determining whether permits were being followed. To address these program needs, the department began in 2002 with a Blue Ribbon Committee made up of representatives from industry, environmental groups, and local governments. To develop recommendations for improving the wastewater program, the committee identified several key areas of concern. First of those was our backlog of our individual MPDS permits, and also the growing complexity of the MPDS permit program and regulations. And one other thing is there was an enormous increase in the number of permits that the department was issuing in the MPDS permit program, the number of areas that were coming into the permit round. And also, DEQ had serious wastewater permitting program resources constraints. They also helped us develop a number of recommendations which are outlined in SB 45. And the Blue Ribbon Committee set targets and goals for us to accomplish, which were also identified in Senate Bill 45. One of the bill's requirements is for us to make an annual report to legislature, and our first annual report was in 2006, and this is our third annual report. And we also, the department, are carefully monitoring our progress in this program, and we do quarterly reports. So that is, each of our regions report on their progress and all of our performance measures on a quarterly basis, so we can keep tabs of what is actually happening throughout the state. Since we began implementing the Blue Ribbon recommendations in 2005, we have experienced both success and challenges in meeting our performance measures. And I'd like to share with you some of the water quality program's successes in 2007 and then follow it up with some of the challenges that the program has had. For the performance in 2007, in order to facilitate better planning and follow-up with our sources, the department developed an annual watershed inspection program. And it outlines where we are really trying to inspect 100% of our major sources each year, and then inspect 100% of those sources that we're going into in selected basins. These would be our minor permits in selected basins. And we expect to meet the goal of 100% of all those inspections by the year 2009. In 2007, we inspected 77% of our major permit sources, we have 70 major permits in the state of Oregon. And we inspected 123% of our minor sources in those selected basins. To issue permits on a watershed basis, we have developed a permit issuance plan, and our target is to have 95% of our permits issued on a watershed basis by the year 2010. And we anticipate that we'll be able to meet this goal if we'll be able to maintain our current staffing and resource levels. The third is that DEQ also tracks the backlog of our permits around the state, and we set up a goal to have that backlog reduced down to 10% by the end of 2007. And until we became involved in several lawsuits and faced EPA challenges on our sanitary sewer overflow language that we have in our permit, we were doing pretty well, and we felt we could have met that goal. We have However, with those challenges, still reduced our permit backlog from the 60% that we had in 2001 to 43% at the end of 2007. And we'll continue to work in trying to reduce that backlog to the 10% goal that we're trying to reach.
Neil, is that for renewal of permits as well?
That is, okay. For the renewal permits. And during 2007, we had 81% of our general permit applications were assigned permit coverage within 30 days of the application being made. And the actual average assignment is about 23 days. The facilities also covered by individual permits are required to submit monthly reports known as discharge monitoring reports, or the DMR. And our goal there was to establish a program where we would review those DMRs and have 100% review of our major sources of the DMRs within 30 days of the conclusion of each month. And the department has been able to meet that goal for our major facilities with the implementation of a data system where those reports are actually come into the department in hard copy, and we enter the data into our database, and we are able to review those reports in a timely fashion.
Neil, without spending too much time, for folks on the committee who aren't familiar with the NPDES program, can you just step back for a minute and explain when a permit is issued, you know, how that works with a facility? In other words, how this process works, that they have to submit the reports. Your staff is not necessarily going out there and doing the monitoring, but they're receiving these reports. You know, I've read through lots of NPDES permits, but I guarantee that probably the majority of folks up here hasn't. So if you could just very quickly, unless they're really walks on this stuff, but if you could just very quickly explain to the committee how that works, because I think it's important. You know, we get asked questions a lot about, obviously, the work that you're doing and how that this, you know, fits in when a permit is issued, how you do the monitoring, and the information that you're requesting from a facility.
Well, certainly, Chair Dingo, members of the committee, the department, in developing a permit under the NPDES permit program, goes through a process where we identify specifically what that particular source is discharging in the environment. And then we go through a process of calculating for each of the parameters that that particular source is discharging, what they're allowed to discharge and still meet state standards. And then within that permit, we specifically identify what the monitoring requirements are for that facility, so they provide us information every month on each one of those standards and each one of the parameters that they're discharging to assure us that they are meeting the limits that we have established in the permits.
So they're doing self-monitoring.
And so they're doing self-monitoring. They provide us, in some cases, daily monitoring on some of the parameters that we have identified, weekly averages and monthly averages and that type of thing. And they're required to report to us every month on this discharge monitoring report. And some of these can be very large and many pages long, where they're collecting tons of information and data on all those specific parameters that are coming in. And we have to check then those monitoring reports against their permits to see, in fact, that the information they're providing and the data they're collecting shows that they are, in fact, in compliance with their permits. So we look at the permit discharge monitoring reports, we examine it against the permit itself and the limits we've established in the permits to see if, in fact, we're meeting that or if there's been any exceedances. And if there are exceedances, then we work with the facility or issuing them a warning letter for that exceedance, or actually taking some type of enforcement action against them for exceeding their permit limits.
And would you ever include or do split sampling? In other words, where, you know, a sample goes to the facility owner and then the sample goes to DEQ, so your own lab is also doing the analysis.
Yes, Chair, members of the committee, when we do inspections on a couple of the facilities as we go around and do our inspection, particularly in major facilities, we will split samples with them. And then we will do our own analysis of those samples at our laboratory and then compare the results back and forth with them. And it's a check on their facility and how well they're monitoring and conducting, you know, their analysis at the facility. And then we check with our laboratory against that work. In some cases, they go out to private laboratories, and again, we're checking the work of the private laboratories.
Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. In addition to the Discharge monitoring reports are received in a DMS system that we have set up for our major facilities. The department is also looking at establishing an electronic discharge monitoring report system, or an EDMR system. And under this, we would try to develop a format where people can report that information from their monthly reports electronically to the department. And if we can accomplish that, we'll be able to put on our minor facilities on that EDMR system and have the 314 minor facilities that we have reporting to us on the EDMR system. And that would also give us an ability to then integrate that data coming in into our overall database and do the same thing, check those minor facilities and the reports that they're providing to us against the limits that they have in their permits and check compliance. And we expect to, if we have both of those systems working, we expect to have 100% of review of both the major facilities and the minor facilities within 30 days once those systems are established. And finally, our performance indicator on enforcement timeliness. The department is currently developing a centralized, computerized system for the compliance database. And when that system is finally set up, we'll be able to establish timeliness goals for our enforcement actions within the department. What I'd like to do is spend a little bit of time on the stormwater program. During the last session, the department did receive much-needed support to the stormwater program, and the funding allowed us to hire a number of staff in the stormwater program to improve the work that we're doing in the stormwater program. We have currently hired 5 limited duration positions, and those people are working on putting through the process of reviewing our industrial stormwater permits, and we hope to have that work completed and 100% of that work done by the end of June of this year. In addition to that, we received 14 permanent positions in the department to provide, again, additional work in the stormwater program, and we're slowly hiring those positions. We have not put on all 14 positions. We're phasing those positions in over time. We also realize that the economy is not the best right now, and we have a little bit of a downturn in Oregon, and so we're waiting to hire positions until, in fact, we know that we're having revenue coming in to support those positions. Now, to give you an idea of what we're working on in there is that in that program, in terms of what we're trying to improve in the program, is we want to be able to review all the management plans that are attached to the stormwater permits as they come in and review all the monitoring reports. We also want to conduct more facility inspections in the stormwater areas, one of the areas that we have the least amount of inspections in the past. So the increase in funding will help us provide some more resources to go out and actually do facility inspections. And then we also want to have those resources to help us in terms of timely review and renewal of the stormwater permits. And finally, it supports our ability to actually have a process where we have public comment on the applications that we have during in the stormwater program. And we also have developed specific performance measures for the stormwater program. And the first of that is to have 100% review of all the plans that come into us for the stormwater permits before and prior to us going out for public notice. We also have identified specifically to conduct 270 inspections in the stormwater permit area. We also want to, as I said earlier, renew all of the industrial stormwater permits by the end of June of this year. And finally, to have an increased complaint response, the staff will be able to respond to complaints within 5 days of receiving it. Now I'd like to move on into the challenges that the department faces with the implementation of the measures that we have developed. And we've had a number of significant challenges to the department in terms of removing and getting to the goal of the 10% backlog of our MPDS permits. And the first of those is the program has really been involved in a great deal of litigation in the last several years. And this litigation has really slowed down our ability to issue permits. A lot of staff time and resources are spent on the litigation and providing discovery documents and depositions to various suits that the department has been engaged in. Also recently, on the report that we provided, the last page of the report provides the information on the suits that we are currently looking at I wasn't able to update it before today, but I also received in the last 2 days two additional Clean Water Act 60-day notices on two additional suits that are in process in the state of Oregon. So those are not included on the list that you have there. Also, EPA has raised some objections to the permit language that the department has used since 2004 for implementation of our bacteria standard. And consequently, we're not able to issue any municipal permits in the state of Oregon for the individual majors or individual minor permits for any of the municipalities until we clear up this issue with EPA on the language for our bacteria standard. And next, DQ has had to postpone issuing any permits in the state that contain a compliance schedule. EPA has undersued by a group on their process for approving Oregon's compliance schedule and the rules that we have in the state of Oregon for allowing DEQ to include compliance schedules and permits. And until we work through that litigation, the department is not issuing any permits in the state of Oregon that have compliance schedules in the permits. And we'll give you an example of what that is. If we're working with a local community, that community needs time to design and construct a new, say, clarifier at a municipal sewage treatment plant, we usually, in the permit, identify that they'll have specific time frames to develop those facility plans, develop the designs, and then get a contractor in and construct that facility. And oftentimes, that time frame is needed to, you know, put everything together, including the financing for those facilities. And when you do that, the facility may in fact be in violation of its permit and meeting its limits in that permit because they need the new facility in order to come into compliance. Well, this particular suit has made it impossible for the department to issue permits with those types of compliance schedules within the permit. And so, again, it's really hampered the ability of the department to move forward with a number of permits in the state. In addition to that, the department has also been petitioned to reconsider 22 permits that we have already issued. And these are challenges to the way we went about issuing the permit in terms of the technology, the calculations that we used in the permits, and the way we interpreted the regulations for issuing those permits. So again, we have 22 permits that we felt we were done with. We issued those, and now we're back at reviewing those and going through the process of reexamining those and providing additional information. And finally, we've lost about 20% of our staff in the water program, and particularly in the water program working in permits, and that has really slowed us down. So in closing, I would like to say that regardless of all these challenges the program has faced in the last year, the managers and the staff are very committed to meeting the performance measures, and we are again in 2008 worked very hard to meet those performance measures. But we are very hopeful that some of these issues that I just mentioned will be resolved in 2008 so we can kind of break the logjam of the permits and get permits issued. And
thank you. Any questions? Representative Kahn?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the update. Granted that you don't choose to make yourself a target of a lawsuit, that's something that happens to you. You don't initiate it. But in the face of the experience of the last year, are there department activities or operations that you're looking at changing to try to diminish the likelihood that you would find yourself brought to legal proceedings in the future and at such a rate?
Chair Dean Powell, Representative Cameron. Yes, definitely. We have in the department developed a number of what we call internal management directives, where we have identified specific issues that we have seen in permits over the years and issues that have come up in comments in the last several years. For example, how we develop and actually design a mixing zone, how we include toxics in the permits, and what type of analysis we use to determine what specific parameters we would put in the permit in terms of toxics. In doing so, we've identified, I think, those areas that we need as a department and staff do a better job in terms of identifying the process and documenting what we have done in those particular areas. Oftentimes we receive comment letters where people are not certain as to what the actual steps were that we followed in putting together, say, for example, the design of a mixing zone, or specifically identifying the concentrations or limits that we're establishing in permits. And some of the suits were really headed in the direction of really trying to find out how that was going on and what we were actually doing. So those internal guidance documents that we've developed over the last couple of years are really specific, trying to resolve those problems and really give guidance across the state so that we're more consistent as an agency, and the current riders around the state themselves are following a set of guidelines that everybody is using. And so we're providing the information that we see people are really starting to ask for. For example, also I talked about the compliance schedule and how you put a compliance schedule on a permit. We're right now actively trying to put together staff resources so we can start putting together again an IMD or internal management directive that really goes through the process of how you would establish that type of compliance schedule on a permit, so that the staff has the direction and the steps they need to follow in order to put one in a permit. And we hope that by doing that, we can reduce the number of suits that are coming in, not only to us, but also to the specific permittees that are receiving those permits.
Thank you. Representative
Gregg. Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mullen, you mentioned that your staff, your department, is down some 20% in personnel. What is the reason for that?
Chair, Representative Gerard, some of it is retirements. Some of it is people leaving the department, going to other departments or other organizations, and just going within the department into other programs. It's just attrition. But it hit us very hard in the last year. We also had, unfortunately, some deaths in the program, too.
Do you have a solution for this, or do you have difficulty in recruiting new people?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Gerard, we do have difficulty in recruiting the program for some of the types of positions that we have. For example, our senior engineer positions in the department are very difficult to recruit for. I personally have had that type of position open in my section in the region for almost a year now, trying to recruit. We did at least two full recruitments nationally trying to get somebody into the position. And so we do have some difficulties getting people into positions that we have open and vacant. And oftentimes we're looking for people with experience in the particular areas that we have in permit writing or in engineering and design review and that type of thing. And we just can't attract or meet the market price for some of those positions and those expertise.
If you're having these kind of problems, Neil, is this going to trickle down to the counties who are trying to hire the same kind of people and who really can't even compete with the salaries that the state of Oregon pays?
Representative Binkfelder, Representative Gerard, I've obviously had discussions with a number of the city public work engineers trying to find out if they have staff they would be willing to come to the department and that type of thing. We commiserate
nice.
Back and forth.
That's not nice now. It's pulling from the city, isn't it?
It is, I think, in the engineering field, really a definite lack of people in the engineering field right now taking positions in the public service. And I know I've talked to professors at OSU, for example, trying to find if they have some students they would like to come down, or people who have graduated in the last couple of years and if they want to come into the department. And the response that I got in one was, literally, we cannot pay them enough. That people leaving school were receiving pay ranges that are higher than we could offer them, and I'm sure the same for the cities. And so it's going to be a difficult challenge for the public agencies to recruit people and get them into positions.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just as a follow-up to that, and full disclosure, my husband's a senior engineer for the Department of Environmental Quality, so I hear it from both ends, because he every day tells me about people who are leaving to go work for the city of Portland, for Clean Water Services, for Clackamas County. Your headquarters are in Portland, so you're competing with the Portland market, and
that's right.
The rates are state rates. So it's and private engineering firms. I think it's not just a problem for your agency, but I hear it from other agencies as well, is senior staff, it's hard to keep experienced people.
That's correct.
Because of the market competition is stiff, especially for scientists and engineers. So it's a real problem, though, because obviously institutional memory is important, and having experience, it takes a long time, my understanding, to learn about writing these permits, implementing them, and making sure that they are aware of each individual permit and what's going on for those facilities. So anything you can, any suggestions you have? I don't know if you've hired some outside folks to come in and do an assessment, make recommendations, but certainly we'd be interested to hear any suggestions you might have.
One of the things that we're looking into, Chair Dinkfelder, is on the potential of actually going to putting out an RFP and putting out private firms to do the engineering review. Unfortunately, the difficulty with that is that you'd have to restrict it to firms that aren't doing any wastewater work in the state of Oregon. So, it's a double-edged sword. You don't know exactly what type of firms you would get or where they would be from to do some of the work. And this is the basic engineering work that we're talking about, reviewing plans and, the pipe sizes and pump sizes and that type of thing. And so we are looking at potentially other mechanisms for doing that and trying to get people on, experienced people on.
I'm sure that other states have looked at that model as well, because I've heard other states talk about that. But it's like I said, it's not just DEQ that I hear this from. I hear it from lots of different agencies. So.
And if I may add, in doing that, of course, the cost is not less than what it would be. We're looking at several hundred dollars an hour for those types of engineers.
Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to follow up on Representative Cannon's question about these lawsuits and, what the effect is having on the program. And your response, you said something to the effect that it has resulted in some changes in the process and some other things. Now, I'm not an expert on this permitting process. I don't know all the gory details of what's involved. But I'm a little curious, when you make these changes, is that done through rulemaking, or is that just something that you sit down with the litigant and work this stuff out and agree to it?
Representative Burley. The response can be many different ways. We can, in fact, sit down with a litigant and try to find out what exactly is the issue and try to identify what we could do as a department to basically address that issue and then have a settlement around what that issue may be. Oftentimes, instead of going through the settlement agreement, it may actually go through the court process, and then a judge is specifically identifying where the deficiencies are. And for example, they may remand a permit back to the department with identifying specifically the areas that they might want us to do additional work in and to augment the record and the permit and to change what the permit is eventually for those particular issues. And the department also, as I said earlier, puts together the guidance in trying to address the issues that we've seen in a number of different lawsuits. So it takes on many different forms. We also, in some cases, are able to sit down with, for lack of a better term, the target of the lawsuit. If we are, in fact, not involved specifically in the lawsuit, where, say, like one of the environmental groups or third parties has sued one of the industries or cities, we try to sit down with that city or industry and identify what we see are the issues that are coming up in that particular lawsuit and try to work with them in terms of what might resolve that particular issue. And we intervene in those particular cases and try to actually assist in trying to get the issue resolved with the litigants and that particular source. So there's any number of approaches or issues that we might be working on to try to actually get a movement in that particular litigation. But it's a difficult realm for us to be involved in. It takes a lot of time for the department.
Thank you. Well, it seems to me that under your challenges here, most of them seem to be focused around the fact that you've got, quote, a great deal of litigation, 22 recently issued permits being petitioned to reconsider. It seems to me that a lot of this stuff is very counterproductive. I mean, if you're trying to get these things taken care of and you're having to go back and revisit all this stuff, you're obviously not getting the work done. Do you have any idea what the cost is involved with all of this? And do you pay settlement costs? I know with some federal lawsuit scenarios, the litigants, the plaintiffs often get their attorney's fees paid for. Do we do that at the state level? And if so, does that come out of your budget?
Representative Dinkfelder, Representative Burley, two answers there is, yes, it's costly. The cost, obviously, that we track because we pay the Attorney General's office for representing us both in the litigation and in an advice before the suits or as we are looking at the suits. And the department right now is spending roughly on average about $45,000 a month for just the water suits and to the billings from the Department of Justice. We don't have or keep track of the actual billings for staff and work that we're doing, you know, in terms of putting together the files and the boxes and the information that we have to provide in discovery. But it is also a secondary hit to the department. And yes, we can be liable for the attorney fees if, in fact, we are not successful in defending ourselves in those suits. And we are right now looking at one specific suit where we have potentially have to pay some attorney fees.
And follow up to that, do we have any type of mediation program? I know that just trying to think about how to maybe reduce some of these costs, and you know, most of them are in the water quality realm, and I understand, you know, some of them are just on broader issues like the temperature TMDL. I sort of lived through that. Is there any alternative routes?
Chair Dean Curler, we haven't looked into any alternative routes at the present time in terms of any mediation and discussion. We certainly could look into that.
I understand that not all lawsuits are going to be able to.
Right.
You're talking about bigger policy issues, but maybe on some of the specific permit.
Right. In terms of some of the 22 reconsiderations, some of those are specifically reconsiderations for the department to look back at the permit. And just if I have some time, one of those, for example, is the Kellogg's sewage treatment plant in Portland, just below the falls. We had a reconsideration a number of years ago, and really the intent of the reconsideration was to have us look again at the way the consultant for the facility calculated how big the mixing zone should have been at that particular facility. And we did that reconsideration within the department. We looked at, you know, the modeling that was done, and then we went back out and identified specifically any changes in the permit that we needed. And once we did that, we changed the permit, reissued the permit, and that was the end of the reconsideration. That was kind of like the easy end of the scale. Then there are reconsiderations that are actually judicial reviews of the permit, where it's not the department necessarily reconsidering it and then reissuing the permit, but it's actually a reconsideration that goes to the courts, and the court is then looking at the issues. And those are very difficult reconsiderations because it's basically a very adversarial type of role.
All right, well, thank you very much for that update. Any other questions for Neil before we move on to a very non-controversial climate water issue? Okay. Thank you, and I'm sure we'll be calling you back because I know you have a lot going on and certainly interested to hear more updates. Glad to hear the stormwater program's going well, and if you don't need those positions, then maybe we'll look at redirecting, you know, those resources to backlog for MPDS, and I don't know if that's possible, but
that's very possible.
Okay, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, we're going to hear from several folks on the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. First, Sue Knapp from the Governor's Office is going to provide an overview, and then we have a couple other folks who are going to provide different perspectives. And again, this is just informational. And I wanted to welcome, we have a committee, we're very fortunate to have up here on the dais, Representative Bentz, who is a former Water Resources Commission member. Welcome. And he's not here officially, but we've invited him to join us anytime. So really appreciate the fact that he has a lot of institutional knowledge on water issues, and glad that you can make it.
Yes, thank you very much for inviting me up, and I look forward to listening to the same issues we've heard 10 years ago.
I thought you were going to say 20 years ago, which would be more depressing. But
I think that people in the Klamath were holding their breath when I was on the commission back in 88 through 96, and they're still holding their breath today.
And that's the way it is with water issues. Oftentimes
they're pretty blue, aren't they?
They don't move or get resolved very quickly, but we are very interested to hear what's been going on down in Representative Gore's part of the state.
Hi,
have for the record,
please? Do some technology magic here.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Suzanne Knapp, and I'm with the Governor's Natural Resources Office, and I'm here to speak to you today about the Klamath, and more specifically, a Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. And if you'll excuse me, I'll get it loaded up here.
Betsy, you want to talk about the information that they have in front of them? Committee members, just you can review that, be helpful.
I think there are two documents on the Klamath agreement. One is a summary document that Suzanne has provided, and then there's also a letter that the committee received yesterday from one of the tribes in California who have been involved in the settlement discussions.
Okay, thank you. Okay, go ahead, Sue.
Okay, thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today about the Klamath. This has been a long haul for a number of parties, and I'm going to give you a simple and short presentation on a very complicated subject. And basically, it's an agreement that 26 parties have put together to try and bring peace on the river, to restore the Klamath, and to maintain community sustainability. So what precipitated this agreement, and I think it's important to understand how we got where we're at. First, the opening, the window of opportunity that was created was the FERC relicensing process for the Klamath project. This got the parties together to decide how we were going to move forward with relicensing under the FERC scenario process. Well, we also had a number of other issues going on in the basin. Klamath water adjudication that has been going on since 1995. There was a recent power rate increase for power users in the Klamath Basin. Bureau of Reclamation's biological assessment. There's been a number of fisheries failures years in a row with a couple of fish kills as well in early 2000. A number of litigation cases going on, and also tribal needs for revitalization. So basically the intent behind the agreement was a precursor to settling a larger context issue of what to do with the hydroelectric projects on the river. This basin agreement is agreement among the stakeholders within the basin to try and keep them whole or to make them whole in the advent of a dam removal scenario. The two agreements, the hydropower agreement and this agreement, go hand in hand. One does not go on forward without the other, and that's important to remember. Just a brief overview of the Klamath Basin. There's 12,000 square miles within the basin, and it straddles both the Oregon and California. There is a lower basin that initiates at Iron Gate Dam in California and proceeds to the ocean. There's 200 miles of river in the lower basin. And then the upper basin, which contains most of the lakes in the Klamath Basin, lower and upper Klamath Lake, Clear Lake, and Tule Lake. And at the upper basin is where the irrigation, Reclamation's irrigation project occurs, as well as irrigation and land use along the upper rivers, the Sprague River, Williamson, Sycan River, and Wood River. Just a brief on the parties that came together to put this settlement agreement together. It was a diverse group of federal agencies and state agencies for both state of California and state of Oregon. We had four tribes that were represented at the table: Hoopa Valley, Yurok, Karuk, and Klamath, and three counties, two of them in California, Siskiyou and Humboldt, and one county in Oregon, Klamath County. We also had water users, the Klamath Project water users, which are those water users on the Reclamation's Klamath Project, and the Upper Basin water users, which are those, as I mentioned, up in the Sprague River Basin primarily. There are also a number of wildlife refuges that are involved in using water. We had fishermen represented it through the Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Association and a suite of conservation groups, and all 26 parties. Here are some basic principles of the restoration agreement, and as I had mentioned previously, one of the basic principles is that our goal is to secure removal of four dams on the Klamath River. That effort is necessary in order to restrain and restore natural production of primarily anadromous fish species. The other principles are to establish a reliable water supply and power supplies for the users of water and power in the Klamath Basin, as well as to contribute to the public welfare and sustainability of the communities in the Klamath Basin. To achieve those principles, there are a number of programs, six programs, fisheries restoration and reintroduction program, a water resources program, regulatory assurances program, power resources program, county mitigation and benefits program, and a tribal program. And to implement all those programs is a governance element. The fisheries program basically has three components. One is introduction and management of reintroduction of primarily anadromous salmonids, but also Pacific lamprey, fisheries restoration plan, and a fisheries monitoring plan. These plans are, the fisheries reintroduction will happen one way or the other, whether the dams are removed or not. With a relicensing scenario, very likely that there will be ladders in place if the dams are relicensed. So one way or the other, we will see anadromous fish in the upper basin. So this plan deals with a phase one approach to do some near-term investigations as to what appropriate stocks would be good for upper basin, initial monitoring and some policy decisions that need to take place. And then a phase two for managing the reintroduced species. Restoration plan is basically habitat restoration for these species as far as riparian habitat, stream channel function, fish passage, and screening. That also has a phase one and phase two element. And then a fisheries monitoring plan to monitor the status of the fisheries, their populations, and also their habitats. And monitoring plan would provide feedback as to guiding the necessary actions for fisheries restoration and management. A key part of the Klamath Restoration Agreement is the Water Resources Program. There are a couple elements to this. The first is a Klamath On Project Water Users Program. These are the irrigators that are on the Reclamation's Klamath Project. Key to this program is a reduced allocation of water to the project irrigators. This had benefits. Not only did it provide additional water for the river and for the lake, but it provided the irrigators with certainty that they would receive that amount of water. It is in a sliding scale in that in dry years, they would receive a reduced allocation when the river and the lake needed the water, and a sliding scale upwards to increasing allocation in wetter years. The irrigators would develop their own plan on how to live within this allocation, and the allocation would essentially provide 100,000 in dry years, 100,000 extra acre feet of water. The plan also provided water allocation for the refuges, again another element of certainty. A couple of refuges at the end of the line never had a guaranteed supply of water, and this agreement will provide that guaranteed supply of water and also provide benefits for fish and wildlife on those refuges. The Water Resources Program, a key part of that is how it's wrapped into the Klamath Basin adjudication. There will be terms within this agreement that resolve water rights, disputes, and claims within the adjudication process between the irrigators, the tribes, and BIA. Another second component of the Water Resources Program is the All-Project Water Users Program, where there is a voluntary retirement of water rights through a compensation program to achieve a desired 30,000 acre feet of water for the upper lake. Klamath, Upper Klamath Lake. There would be an element to protect those flows that are transferred in stream, an element to protect and restore the riparian corridors along the various rivers in Upper Klamath Basin, and of course an off-project water settlement that we call OPWAS, which would be related to the Klamath River Basin adjudication to settle claims within that process. If this settlement is agreed to by the parties, then basically this settlement agreement would be encapsulated and presented to the adjudicator as a form of water settlement. That's how the adjudication fits into this piece. There are also additional components of the Water Resources Program to increase water storage within the Upper Basin as part of dike breaching and other actions along the Williamson Wood and Agency Lake areas. The investigation of future storage opportunities in Upper Klamath Lake. Long Lake is one that folks know about, and that is continuing and being in continued investigation of that opportunity, as well as others that may arise. There's also an effort to develop a drought plan for emergency situations, for drought, extreme drought situations, and also looking ahead in the climate change scenario. And this plan will be developed by the parties themselves to make sure that any pain that is felt is spread equitably among the users. So we also have an environmental water component, and that component of environmental water in Upper Klamath Lake and the Klamath River is achieved through these measures that you see here, a dam removal, diversion limitations, which I spoke about, water rights retirements in the Upper Basin, water storage, conservation, and an interim water leasing program before the diversion limitations are in place. This additional water will be protected in stream, primarily for fisheries purposes and basin restoration. And there will be a real-time management element to this environmental water with establishment of a technical advisory team with entities, agency, and otherwise that have expertise and interest in water management. The program also provides for regulatory assurances for the Fisheries and Water Resources programs, and these assurances are through habitat conservation plans and general conservation plans for incidental take permits for users of lands and water in the basin that will eventually see the reintroduction of ESA-listed species. And as I mentioned, biological opinions, Bureau of Reclamation will use this settlement, this agreement, as a biological assessment to provide to the federal agencies to initiate consultation over. There's also assurances as far as water diversion and approvals, meaning that that which is agreed to in the amount that is diverted will be assured to the maximum extent possible. There will be an effort to avoid adverse impact to the users of lands and waters in the Klamath Basin, and there will be provision of screening. In particular, the Bureau of Reclamation will seek funds for screening of key diversion facilities on the Klamath project. There's also a power resources program for the users of that have been involved in the previous contract with PacifiCorp on power. Not to get into the details of this too much, but power rates have gone up for these users after the conclusion of a contract, a power contract, for the last 50 years. And this effort, this program, is an effort to bring power cost security for these power users, affordable power for these power users. Part of the power cost security is an interim power sustainability fund. And this fund would be essentially to credit the power bills of users in the basin so that they could attain a lower cost of power. And also a long-term renewable power program, an investment in a long-term renewable power investment program that would provide a revenue stream to do the same thing, to provide a credit to offset the power cost to the irrigators. Another element of the power resources program is a shift of reclamation power loads on authorized uses, reclamation authorized uses to another source of power, that being federal project use power or reserve power. There's also energy efficiency and conservation. Klamath Basin has great potential to be more efficient in the infrastructure in water delivery within the basin, particularly in the pipe delivery and pumping. And also there's potential for conservation, on-farm conservation, and more efficient use of water. Another component is the county's mitigation and benefits program. This is an effort to keep the counties whole in the event of potential dam removal. One of the greatest concerns for the counties was a loss of tax revenue. And speaking for Klamath County specifically, it was a loss of land value with water rights retirements. So this agreement would seek to compensate them for that loss of tax revenue. It would also provide for economic development opportunities and investigations for all these counties in the advent of a changing landscape. A changing landscape in terms of a free-flowing river could provide great economic opportunity. And this is so investigation into those opportunities and how to plan for and provide for is needed. Also, part of this program is measures to rehabilitate and restore shorelines and lake beds in the advent of a free-flowing river, and for mitigation of impacts and other losses that may occur. Last but not least is a tribal program for the four tribes that I had mentioned. Tribes are a very key part of the whole Klamath Basin, and they have received in this agreement a standing of being a collaborative manager for the fisheries restoration and reintroduction program, and have asked that they receive technical and human resources to be able to participate on par with other agencies in fisheries restoration and reintroduction. Also, once fishing opportunities, harvest opportunities are expanded and strengthened, they will need assistance in marketing and processing and the sale of transport of this fisheries commodity. There's also a recognized need for tribal revitalization and promoting cultural preservation and developing self-government institutions and providing for long-term economic revitalization. Part of that for the Klamath tribes in particular is the acquisition of the Mazama project, currently privately owned, but if acquired by the tribes would provide them with economic security and revitalization. Also part of this, as I had mentioned, is a governance for this agreement, where they're establishing a Klamath Basin Coordinating Council comprised of the parties of the agreement and also new parties that would want to sign on to the agreement, with opportunity for public participation in guiding governance of the agreement. And as mentioned, there's a technical advisory team for assisting with water management in the basin and providing recommendations to Department of Interior or Reclamation for management of stored water. So in essence, just to sort of recap what Oregon's commitments and contributions to this agreement are, there's a number of agencies that would be involved and have been involved in this agreement development. ODFW, of course, would be the lead on any reintroduction plan and would need to receive from its commission approval and a policy decision for reintroduction, and would be involved in fisheries management. Water Resources would be involved not only in completing the water adjudication, but also in water regulation and management once that adjudication is completed. DEQ is involvement is in primarily right now in 401 certification for the hydro relicensing, but also TMDL implementation for the Upper Klamath Basin water bodies. Department of Energy would have play a part in the Power Resources Program for the irrigation community, and OECD could potentially have grants that Klamath County could seek for its economic revitalization. The governor's office would be seeking legislation to fund certain aspects of the agreement, and would be participating in the governance. And of course, your part, the legislature's part, would be considering approval of that legislation. That is it for my presentation, and I do want to wrap this up by saying that this has been a Herculean effort by the parties to come together, to compromise, to collaborate, and to establish relationships in order to achieve peace on the river in a basin that has long seen strife and conflict. And our goal is to try to the best that we can to stem that conflict, to bring sustainability to the communities, and maintain the relationships that we have established in moving forward with this agreement.
Thank you, Sue.
Thank you.
I just want to mention, we have the room until 3 o'clock, so if my colleagues are interested in staying, we'll continue this conversation. We have many people in this room who want to come up and you know, say their few words about this. Certainly, if there's anybody who would like to come up, if we have time, you know, you're welcome to do that. Sue, I'm going to ask you to stay there, and I'm going to ask Sustainable Northwest, who's here, to come up and make a few comments, and then we'll open up for questions. So, Martin Goebel from Sustainable Northwest. Welcome, Martin. And James Hunt. And for the record, please state your name.
Madam Chair, thank you very much, and members of the committee, thank you very much for having us today. Thank you.
Thank you.
Governor's office for the great presentation and the wonderful work you've been doing with us down in the Klamath Basin. I am accompanied today by James Honey, who is our point person in the Klamath Basin, and if we have questions later on, he will assist me in helping to answer those questions. So I have about 8 or so minutes of presentation, and I hope you'll forgive me for reading some of it because it's very important to state it correctly. Sustainable Northwest is an organization that's existed since 1994. We care deeply about rural communities and the rural communities of Oregon and all the Pacific Northwest. We work on economic stability, social vitality and resilience, and of course ecological, the ecological underpinning that that provides the support structure for any economy and any society and community. We work on practical and tangible solutions to problems. We have not worked heretofore on a basin-wide level the way we have now in the Klamath Basin, and we too want to join the governor's office to congratulate this Herculean effort that local parties have made. Our fundamental message to you today is twofold. We support this settlement agreement because it takes a comprehensive approach, a systemic approach, to what is needed to achieve community health and stability for rural communities in the Klamath Basin, of which environmental restoration is the primary concern. And secondly, we have firm evidence and experience that achieving restoration takes active work and active partnership, and that without that partnership and environmental focus to collaboration and so on, this whole thing could unravel and fall apart. So that relationship building component to all of this that is so different to what existed in the early part of this century has changed dramatically, and I think that's a very important point to make. We got involved in the Klamath Basin as early as 2002 by invitation of one rancher in the Spring River Valley. And that success, in a very small but significant way, started knitting together the relationships that now have resulted in large measure with this very large group of people and organizations that have crafted this wonderful agreement. We are not here representing that group. We are not an official stakeholder of the Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement, but we have worked very closely with all of them, hand in hand, trying to be as supportive as we possibly can as a nonprofit organization that seeks to solve problems in a very creative way. So we hope that you will hold more hearings in the future, asking the parties themselves to come before you to answer questions of a more technical and scientific and social and economic nature. I want to just go to the points of the paradigm shift that I think is very important to emphasize here. 2 years, as was mentioned, or over 2 years and 26 parties, is very important to underscore. As you all remember, in 2001, we had some terrific conflict that continued on in 2002 with this back and forth whether we were going to support fish or irrigators, and that kind of very acrimonious and litigious condition was really taking us quickly nowhere. That has changed completely now. From a purely environmental focus, it recognizes, the parties recognize that restoration is not about preventing actions, but about actively working to restore ecological function that provides suitable conditions for species and for people in this wonderful basin that we call the Klamath. So Sue has done a very, very great job of outlining the agreement for you, so which I was prepared to do. It does call for dam removal as one of the linchpins of the whole thing, increased flows, restoration.
I'll just talk about water as choking him
up. Thank you very much. Representative Brent. It also has a very comprehensive restoration component, economic revitalization and diversification for both tribes and other rural communities. And I think it's important to mention that this is a groundbreaking plan to invest in the environment and in the economy and the social structure of the basin in a holistic sort of way, rather than trying to achieve one success for one piece of the basin versus or at the expense of another. So we really think this is important. I won't belabor the situation that was there in the early part of the century, but all of you witnessed it in the papers, and I just want to say how different we think the social fabric that has been knitted together in the process of putting this agreement together is today. I do, however, want to emphasize three main components what we think are important components of this Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement. The first is the environmental component. There is now a broad coalition supporting dam removal. This is and was a tough issue for the irrigation community, and we have to recognize just how deep they had to reach into their souls to make this to come to this conclusion. But it's something they are willing to do and accept, as they asked others to accept basic economic and water needs for themselves. The second thing on the environmental component is that removal is the lowest, we believe, the lowest cost approach to federal agency mandated volitional fish pastures that will bring anadromous fish, especially Chinook salmon, back into the upper basin. The third is that negotiations are ongoing, we understand, with PacifiCorps, and they are, as we are told, quite productive. I think it's very important for us to understand as Oregonians that PacifiCorps will have to be protected from unlimited liability, and we will have to find creative ways to make it economically possible for them to agree to remove dams. Removal creates a combination of factors which, with improved flows, can lead to recovery. These include reducing thermal dead zones for migrating fish, attacking the point source of toxic parasites that build up in the reservoirs, ending peaking regimes that move the river flows up and down by 100% sometimes every day, and allowing passage for upriver spawning. It puts new water in stream for fish, as has already been outlined. It has been taken in combination with removal and a suite of restoration actions, now in a very positive environment. These flows are deemed to be sufficient by a majority of agencies, tribes, and environmental groups at the table to be sufficient for fish recovery. Wildlife refuges, I think this is important to reemphasize, are guaranteed water allocations for the first time, and that's very important. The effect of all of this is that we move away from single species, single issue, single factor management to managing and improving the multiple causes that conspire to rob the whole ecosystem and social system of semblance of real health. On the economic component side, the agreement recognizes that environmental health without community stability and economic welfare is absolutely meaningless. Communities threatened with extinction will fight, and all energy is devoted to litigation and not to recovery. And in this case, we have tried to flip that around. Thus, it provides predictability of water delivery so farmers can know with certainty that what their growing seasons will be like, even as reviewing actual flows over the past 4 years provides fisheries experts knowledge with great confidence in their modeling as to how much additional water will head downstream. It provides a down payment to the irrigation community that they must match with sweat equity and investment to build a renewable energy infrastructure that will replace power on the grid and bring revenues to the community to offset the increased power costs that Sue outlined. Keeping ranchers and farmers economically stable is not a subsidy. We really want to emphasize this. It's important to keep the key economic sector, this key economic sector, and to maintain domestic food production right there in Klamath, and in particular to avoid a massive turnover of open space and habitat that threatens to bring the kind of changes that we've seen in other parts of the region, particularly the West and places like Medford, and thus affect places like Klamath County. Let's remember that restoration and resource management takes active work. That means labor and employment. And farmers and ranchers are our best workforce to help us do that. And finally, to invest in tribal economies, long the greatest losers of this in our Western history. Again, the focus on economic and community stability creates an environment for moving forward rather than wallowing in the litigious and acrimonious status quo. Finally, there's a social component to all of this. The most overlooked component of it all is this lack of social fabric that I think it's going to take to really achieve many of these goals over the long term. Over the past 3 years or more, we have witnessed the evolution of relationships that didn't exist before. Key environmental, tribal, and agricultural groups have gone from poisonous mistrust, in many quarters at least, to really building a new sense of community together. This is important because no document or contract or agreement can ever cover all the contingencies that will be needed into the future, or that we can foresee into the future. Instead, it's these relationships of trust and shared vision that will help us overcome the inevitable unanticipated consequences and needs of any action. Some claim that this is a Bush administration-directed effort. While we saw significant and appropriate high-level agency participation in this effort, it was mostly community-led, in fact, in our estimation, entirely community-led. It's the people on the river, whether it's the tribe or the agricultural community, that have the greatest stake in this issue, and it is they who have the primacy in leading for solutions. And Sue outlined also the coordinating council that will be developed. Again, it's going to be mostly locally led, and we think that's a very important and critical part of this agreement. There's a few asks that we want you to consider as we move forward. The Klamath Basin Restoration Agreement began with dialogue and with building this broad constituency. We hope you'll support the continuation of that constituency building process. We also want to ask you to consider a few other things. First, there is much technical nuance to the environmental components of this agreement. We urge this committee not to base their judgment on overviews such as the one we're providing you today. These are just overviews. But on detailed technical hearings that would show with tribal scientists and other scientists how this agreement can really, really work. The second, we need to ensure the Pacific Corps hears loud and clear that it can be a partner in restoring the stability and ecological health of this basin, and we will need our state PUCs to help Pacific Corps recuperate the cost of dam removal and, of course, limit their liability. Third, while the Klamath Irrigation Project districts have not voted yet and are in the process of doing hearings on this, we are hopeful that they will support the agreement, and the district voting begins as early as this week. The official off-project representatives, called the Klamath Off-Project Water Users Association, as you know or may know, will oppose this agreement, as do many other constituents. We don't pretend that this is all of the people who need to be in agreement. This is a big first step, though. We believe this is a partial result we hope that you'll continue helping us build this agreement into the future. Our conversations with the Klamath tribes and with settlement-oriented off-project irrigators, some of them anyway, indicate that both parties want to believe something is achievable on the off-project side of all of this. And for that reason, there is a Section 16 in the agreement that allows for that to happen into the near future. We believe this process should start immediately, and we understand the Klamath County Commissions are considering promoting talks, and Klamath tribes are planning a call to the off-project community to enter discussions as soon as possible. And if these efforts gather steam in the next few weeks and months and show signs of promise, we hope that this committee will support appropriate stays in the adjudication process to allow the energies of all the parties to be focused on this, what we call the OPWAS process. Finally, we need Oregon's commitment to join state and federal agencies and philanthropies in the business community to make this plan a reality. The agreement calls for $400 million of new money. That's a lot of money, over and above the average annual federal contributions that are there already. So we're really going to have to gather forces to make something like this happen. This may seem like a lot, but we compare it to the disaster relief and emergency farm bill investments made since 2001 and believe that we can save significant tax dollars in the future over a 50-year term life of this agreement as the solutions to this Klamath Basin's turmoil come to fruition. So in conclusion, I'd just like to say the Oregon can continue its already recognized national leadership in sustainability by embracing this as a national example of community and ecosystem health restoration. A focus on community sustainability and stability encompassing a real environmental recovery allows the basic infrastructure of the basin to redirect from conflict and litigation to solution and recovery. There is a broad and wide coalition coming together here, and we hope it will strengthen with greater agricultural support as off-project tribal water issues are addressed. Opponents on the margins, both for agriculture and the environmental community, are principled, and a dialogue must continue. But we cannot hold progress for this agreement hostage because a few oppose it. Critics may attack it from one element or one flank or another. There's always room for more solutions in this to solve this issue. But our challenge as a state and as a nation is not how to pursue a fictional maximum in economic productivity or environmental restoration, but to find a resilient, stable whole that is simultaneously addresses all and creates reinforcement mechanisms that solidify sustainability. Fighting is rapidly being replaced by collaboration, as I've emphasized many times, And we hope that you and our state will support this settlement agreement process in the coming weeks and months so that we can make the settlement agreement a reality. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have about 15 minutes. I think we're going to take some questions now, and then there's some other folks, I think, that have some views that they'd like to share. And then we do have time in our schedule next week, so, Sue, we may ask you to come back, especially if there's additional questions. I think we have some holes that we can fill, and I was expecting that we may ask you to come back, so I hope that can work in your schedule.
That's perfectly fine. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Why don't we take some questions now, and then I know we have some other folks that would like to come up and share their views. Representative Card.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a comment, and I have several questions. It'll probably take us to 8, 9 o'clock tonight.
I figured that. And you're welcome to stay here till 8 or 9 tonight.
Oh, thank you very much, Madam Chair. Ms. Knapp, Mr. Goebel, Mr. Honey, welcome to a hornet's nest. First of all, I've sat here for about the last hour trying not to become outraged at the claims that I have heard as the representative from Klamath Falls. Settlement is a misnomer. The document is an agreement between 26 organizations, of which only two actually own some land or have a water right involved. In a meeting this week in Klamath Falls, in which some 200 people showed up, 70% of the basin residents oppose the settlement. To hear you describe this as a positive community involvement is somewhat of a surprise. This document's 250 pages long and is very complex. To hear you describe voluntary retirement of water rights by the off-project users, that's an involuntary retirement of water rights. They do not agree to it. So how can you sit there and say it's voluntary? Pacific Power and Light owns the four dams and are probably the key ingredient, along with several other things in this. They were not part of the settlement agreement. They were not part of the 26 organizations that were invited to participate. I find that astonishing. And that the whole thing revolves on removal of the four dams, but nobody thought to invite the power company who owns them. Ms. Knapp, you made a statement that basically said that water adjudication is going to trump any settlement rights. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Garrard, I don't believe I used the word trump. This agreement would be presented to the adjudicator as a possible solution to the Klamath Basin adjudication.
The adjudication is scheduled to be over very shortly, probably before the settlement ever really reaches any point of authenticity or reality. So therefore, I'm assuming that the water adjudication, because so much a part of this plan has to do with water rights. And this plan not only requires state organizations to manufacture new Oregon statutes, but also to violate existing Oregon law to make this settlement happen. That's in the document.
Representative, we have the Water Resources Department here if you would like them to come up to address the adjudication.
I don't know how long you want to go.
Well, we have the room till 3.
How long do you want me to...
We could, if Tom wants to come up, would you like to try to address that specific issue?
I don't think he wants
issue?
To come up, does he?
Well, he would be sitting way in the back. If
yes, that would be fine. I'd welcome.
Would have been in full retirement by now because we keep saying Tom's retired.
That's right. I heard that was last year.
That's why we have 8 positions up here. But as I mentioned, we can have continued discussions on this next week. But certainly if you want to address the adjudication issue, appreciate you being here for the record.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me up. My
Go ahead.
Name is Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. The adjudication process in the Klamath began about 25 years ago, and we've been to the Supreme Court and back. At this point, we are in the latter stages of the adjudication. The adjudicator is planning and is scheduled to present his final determination to Klamath County Circuit Court in approximately 2 years. We've done a tremendous amount of work, both the adjudicator and the department, and I say both because we try to keep them separated in this process. There were a total of 730 claims filed by persons claiming water rights in the Klamath Basin. That generated 5,664 contests or challenges to those claims. And today, 96% of those challenges or contests have been resolved. Granted, the big ones are left. But the adjudicator has laid out a schedule. There is a considerable amount of process left before the final order of determination is filed, and during the next 2 years he will be actively pursuing those steps.
Thank you for the clarification.
Tom, can I ask you that question then? Would water adjudication trump basically anything that's agreed upon in the settlement?
Madam Chair, Representative Gord, as Susan stated, this agreement, if it is ratified, along with the other agreements that have been reached through the adjudication process, will be forwarded or have been forwarded to the adjudicator. The adjudicator will consider those and subsequently incorporate them in the final order of determination as it is presented. The Water Resource Department has been involved in this settlement process. We are sitting at the table, and one of our key interests is to assure that whatever agreement comes out is consistent with Oregon water law and does not erode any of the authorities that Oregon Water Resource Department has in administering Oregon water law. At this point, we feel that the agreement is consistent with Oregon water law. You can take pieces of it and say, oh, but you can't do that under current law, and that's probably true if you look at, I'll say, the extreme examples. At the same time, the agreement between on-project folks, the tribe, and others on how water is divided, that type concept is incorporated in Oregon water law under, for example, a rotation agreement, where water users with varying priority dates can join together and decide how they are going to manage the waters that are available to them. That's one example.
Well, that's my understanding, that you have to have all of the water rights owners agreeing. If one doesn't agree, there is no agreement. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Gord, you have, well, what would result is that with the agreement, Water Resource Department would not be able to regulate off any water users who have water rights senior to the most junior party to the agreement.
Is it within current Oregon law to transfer a water right not subject to transfer?
Madam Chair, Representative, no. Oregon water law requires that, or states that only water rights subject to transfer may be transferred, and that also involves a review to make sure that any transfer would not cause injury to existing water right holders.
Again, you stop me whenever you want to.
Well, and here's what we're going to do. We've just asked the. Do you want to take up? You want to yield your time? Representative Burley might yield his time. my suggestion, we have some time next week, and I've already asked, we had some other folks who wanted to come up today, and I'm asking if they'd be available next week. Are there other folks in the room that would be available next week to continue this conversation? There is no decision in front of us. This is an informational hearing. Certainly, it's something I think is of importance to the state. It is an issue that has been going on, as we've heard from the good representative Vince, for many, many years, so it's not going to necessarily go away. Did you want to come up, sir?
We would like to, we traveled the bar and knew about this at the last minute.
Sure, why don't you come on up and...
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I may, while they're doing that, I just, you know, I've got a lot of questions too, but there's one comment, one thing that I do want to touch on while Suzanne's still here. You know, I picked up on this aspect about the offset for the loss of tax revenue relative to the property taxes. And, of course, this Mazama block, 90,000 acres, if it turns into trust land, goes off the tax rolls. But, you know, we have allowed our timber-dependent communities to be decimated. We've run an industry almost out of the state of Oregon. For the last 6 years, we've been begging Congress for these welfare checks, and we still are today to keep these county governments running. So now when I see a program that's going to be based on $400 million additional to keep landowners and counties and everybody whole and everybody at peace, it raises some serious warning flags with me. Let's be careful, because we're already having one problem, and now we're going to go and run down this road and jump into another one where we're going to be dependent on having all this money, and I don't know where it's going to come from, because we're losing our industries. So that's the only comment I have at this point.
Thank you, Representative Burley. Why don't you come up, and gentlemen, are you available next week to come back for questions? And I'm sure there's some other folks in the room, too, that would like to. And again, this informational hearing, so it's, you know, if you can come back, that would be great. And really appreciate your patience. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you, Representative Ben Builder.
Make sure to state your name.
My name is Roger Nicholson, and I am president of Resource Conservancy. I represent Upper Basin water users. We represent over 50,000 acres of Upper Basin water users. We were not involved in this process, even though we asked and petitioned to be part at the table. The net result is that 30,000 acre feet of our water is now being proposed to be taken as part of this proposal. I want to repeat that. We were never part of this proposal. We petitioned. The only representation we had was through a power user group. The gentleman to my immediate left represented that power group. But we tried and tried to be part of the process and tried to participate, even to the extent via the power group. We agreed to a conceptual agreement whereby we would have been part of it. And at that time, it was a consensus group. This was a consensus group making these decisions. We agreed to a conceptual agreement whereby we would furnish 30,000 acre feet as of a 2001 base year. There's been a number of our ranches taken since 2001. 98,000 acres of Upper Basin agriculture land has been bought by the federal government and or the Nature Conservancy in the last 20 years. The Klamath Basin originally started with 500,000 acres of irrigated land. 260,000 were off project. The bigger part of what you hear Sue talk about is the minor part of the original irrigated acreage within the Klamath Basin. Off project was the majority of that. As I say, 98,000 acres have previously been taken, yet we want peace as much as anybody. We joined, even though we were denied representation, we provided indirect input through our power group. That agreement called for three things, as well as 30,000 acres as of 2001, 30,000 acre feet, but to be diminished by the amount that was taken from 2001 to the present. Most of that 30,000 acre feet would be covered automatically with what the federal government purchased and the Nature Conservancy purchased since that time. But to be part of that, we were guaranteed through the conceptual agreement water assurances whereby no more of our water would be taken, ESA assurances in case of calls for the endangered species, as well as the same ability to get affordable power as the project users. Between the time of the conceptual agreement and the final agreement, the group was changed from consensus to majority. Our power indirect representation through our power group was dumped, essentially. We were thrown underneath the railroad train, and the 30,000 acre feet in its entirety was called for coming out the end with absolutely no assurances. The only body that spoke in our favor to provide us access was the state of Oregon through the Attorney General's office, trying to tell the group that we needed and had to be as part of this if this was going to be a viable settlement. You had a major stakeholder that was deliberately left out, and that stakeholder's water was taken. There's no way to sugarcoat it. This is precisely what happened, and each and every one of these facts can be verifiable. Now, Representative Gard, I'm glad you pointed out the public hearing that took place in Klamath County. The paper reported 70% of the testimony was in opposition. I would say from being there was closer to 90% of the testimony in opposition of the local people. Despite the fact the Sustainable Northwest, Portland Environmental Group, sugarcoating this, that somehow this was okay, the fact of the matter is, for the local people, this agreement is not okay. The county commissioners went back and decided they would have to open up negotiations to even think about affording this settlement their approval, and that is in process right now to try to bring the off-project irrigation people into the agreement and to treat them fairly and equitably. Right today, they are not treated fairly and equitably.
Okay, thank you so much for sharing your comments. We have about 2.5 minutes left before we get kicked out of this room, so please state your name. And
I'm Edward Bartel. I'm president of the Klamath Off-Project Water Users. We were a party. As Mr. Nicholson said, we've always wanted a settlement, and in fact, we strongly supported the settlement framework. Unfortunately, the parties just decided to run over us and not honor the commitments they made in that settlement framework. And just as illustrative of what we're looking at, the tribes have filed for claims for literally more water than physically exists during most years. And this is a graph, and I'll hand it to the committee. This is a graph showing the tribal in-stream claim versus actual flow of the river. Over a 70-year period, we would be allowed to irrigate about 4 years out of 70 with these ridiculously high claims. We wanted these resolved. This settlement doesn't resolve these claims, and what it instead advocates doing is, after the tribes have got the 90,000 acres and the 30,000 acre feet, then we'll go negotiate for our assurances afterwards, and that's that Section 16 that Sue talked about. So we just don't think that there's, and we don't think that the power rate is real either, because it involves having to go back to Congress a few years down the road, and also requires that we get approval of the same committee that outvoted us all the time to get any power benefits for our off-project members. So we think we've always been willing to make a reasonable settlement, but this is not a reasonable settlement, and I encourage the committee to not support any settlement until all parties are on board and really provides the benefits that we all thought we had in the framework.
Thank you for sharing your comments today. I just want to remind folks this is an informational hearing. We are not going to be voting on anything today or in the future, this special session. So appreciate you sharing your thoughts and coming here today. With that, we're going to close the informational hearing, and we will next week, please check the schedule. We're going to look at what bills we have left to hear for the special session. We're going to make some more time for folks who weren't able to comment. Just a reminder, there's we have no meeting tomorrow. So you have a free day, but we will be meeting, I think, on Monday. Is that correct?
That's right.
And so with that, I will close the informational hearing on the...